Calendar this morning is, and I hope I pronounced this correctly, Colmus Enterprises versus Pines LLC, case number 58911. Council ready to proceed, Ms. Folsom?
Ready, Your Honor.
Mr. Cox?
Yes, Your Honor, ready to proceed.
All right. Go ahead, Ms. Folsom.
Good morning. My name is Sue Ellen Folsom. I represent with Mr. Peterson, Lori Colmus, and Colmus Enterprises. In 1983, Donald Blaney recorded Land Map 57, dividing a full section of land in southwest Reno into 15 40-plus acre lots. He provided for reciprocal 50-foot wide access utility easements. Those easements were described by meets and bounds in the recorded map. Mrs. Colmus purchased two of those lots. Some of the members of the Pines Group purchased the remaining 13 lots. There are also a couple of members of the Pines Group who purchased additional lots outside of Land Map 57. Mrs. Colmus developed a small portion of her two lots. Pines Group, however, planned differently. They worked as a group with the idea of developing a tentative map for all of their lots plus the adjoining lots. The idea of the Pines Group was to prepare and get approved a tentative map and then sell that map with the properties to a developer. In order to develop their properties the way the Pines intended, they needed, first of all, to realign the access utility easements as they went through the Colmus property. In addition to that agreement, to an agreement for realignment, they also needed, in order to perform the development plan by their tentative map, they needed an agreement or a grant from Colmus of easements for slopes, drainage, maintenance, landscaping, and so on. Without obtaining either of these agreements, in February of 2006, the Pines Group submitted its application for tentative map to the City of Reno. What Pines Group did was take a gamble that it could get those agreements or in place before the application came to a vote before the planning authorities. When that did not happen, the Pines owners proposed Condition 39. May I?
Mm-hmm.
Would I have a blow-up of this is just Condition 39 from the approval of the Pines tentative map and amended PUD application. This is proposed by the Pines, which is to say that prior to the approval of any final map or permit, including grading, they will have easements in place, they will have an agreement with the schools, the neighboring Quail Valley and Pines schools, grading, roadway, property walls, retaining structures, sanitary, sewer utility, and flood control improvements. And furthermore, if at the time of the permit no such agreement exists, they shall demonstrate that they have adequate easements in place for installation, construction, ownership, access, maintenance, all proposed improvements for grading, roadways, rock and walls, containing structures, etc., etc., etc.
When they went before the City Council, the suggestion was made that they get those agreements in place or the easements in place before going forward. And again, the Pines engineers represented to the City Council that if they could not get those agreements with Colmus, they would go ahead and build out on the existing easements that they had and that they would be able to do that. Now, although Pines admitted to the planning authorities that they didn't have agreements with Colmus, after they got their map approved and their amended PUD, they sued Colmus. They sued Colmus alleging that there was an agreement on the relocation of the roadway utility easements. They did not sue for easements for drainage or anything else. They made no allegation as to those easements.
Mrs. Kulmus denied, obviously, that any such agreement was made. We tried the case. The court found that no agreement had been made for relocation of easements. Court added on to that, no agreement was made, no development agreement was made, which is what would incorporate the other easements, drainage, landscaping, slopes, et cetera. But then the court turned around and found that there had been an agreement to negotiate. Granted judgment on that agreement for what is demonstrated here on this map, which just shows the two Kulmus lots. Easements that basically the court gave carte blanche to the Pines to prepare an easement map across Kulmus for whatever they needed. And so what came out of that was easements that were not even before the court in the course of the trial. What came out of that was this map. If you see, I mean, the 50-foot wide relocated plan easements are these. This little piece in the middle.
Ms. Wellstone, can I ask you a question before you get further into the map? Going back to this agreement to negotiate, did this come up at the very end of the trial, just out of the blue? Did you ever contest the fact that perhaps Nevada doesn't recognize agreements to agree and perhaps agreements to negotiate? Was it tried by consent, or how did this happen?
The first mention of an agreement to negotiate came up a few days before trial, and we promptly filed an objection to there being any trial of that claim because it wasn't in the pleadings, and we were not going to try it by consent.
Did you also indicate that there's a law in Nevada that doesn't recognize them?
We did. We said, you know, and if there was an amendment to the pleadings, it would be futile because there was law in Nevada that agreements to agree, or even agreements to negotiate. In the Silver State case, is an agreement specifically to negotiate, too indefinite for enforcement. At the end of the trial, after all the evidence was in, Pines people did make an affirmative, formal motion to amend to conform to the evidence. Again, we opposed that, arguing that the standard for conforming to the evidence had not been met, because in order to justify a trial, you know, an argument that the issue had been tried, they had to put in some actual evidence that was independent of the evidence, other evidence in the case that went directly to that issue, and they did not do that. But, you know, without ever even addressing the standard for, amendments conforming to the evidence, the judge allowed for the amendment alleging the claim to negotiate. But even then, that, you know, I mean, the motion to amend was very specific. It was a claim to negotiate the relocation of existing easements. That language is quoted directly from the motion. That motion to amend was nothing to say that there was an agreement to negotiate massive easements of all kinds and of all sizes. It was simply limited to the relocation issue.
Could I interrupt you a moment?
Of course.
The map that you have in the well of the courtroom looks different than Appendix 0948. But are they really the same maps, or can you tell me?
I'm not sure what Appendix 0948 is, although I can look it up.
It's a map, Summit Engineering map, that I think depicts the easements that were part of the initial grant and then the easements that were contemplated tentative maps. But all of that aside, my question is, for both counsel, is what maps were attached to the affidavits and what legal effect should be given to the exchanged affidavits? I mean, people signed affidavits under oath. They say what they say. So what is the effect of the affidavits that people exchanged and the maps that were attached thereto? Could you address that, please?
Yes. Well, first of all, there were no maps attached to the affidavits.
Are there any in existence?
Yes. This is the owner affidavit signed by Mrs. Kulmus. Okay, this is language that's proposed by the city, which is required of a person or a property owner if the person making the application has some portion of their development plan on that other person's land. Because Pines was planning improvements through Kulmus' property, they had to have an affidavit from Mrs. Kulmus. Now, you know, when I say they had to have an affidavit, it's a, you know, it's a package requirement from the city planning people. It's not a consent of any kind, clearly, because no one ever treated it as a consent of any kind. It doesn't have language of consent. It simply says, you know, there's going to be an application.
Well, it says more than that. Ms. Kulmus is, I assume this is her signature, but it says, and that I authorize Wood Rogers, Inc. to request development-related application on my property.
Yes.
And I assume then that when this has been submitted, there is an application. It identifies what they're applying for and how the application infringes on Ms. Kulmus's property. Is that not all the case?
That is true.
Including the proposed easements by Wood Rogers on the Kulmus land.
Doesn't include the proposed easements, but it does include probably what is the equivalent. It includes
shows the proposed ingress and egress. Isn't that what the map is that you're showing us there?
No, actually it's not.
Okay.
This map goes beyond that. I'm going to first answer the first question.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
Which map was in existence at the time of the affidavit?
Mm-hmm.
And that is this map, which is a map prepared by...
Do you mind holding that up? Maybe...
I might even manage to put it in here in front of us.
Okay. Maybe our staff could help you there. Does that work all right? Okay, thank you.
Affidavit was signed in November, and, you know, it was... significantly, it was for access through amended PUD, which is not the school's property. The amended PUD was the Pines property. So, I mean, there's that problem with the affidavit, among others. But more to the point of the map. This is a map prepared by Wood Rogers from the Summit Engineering Plans. So it has Mrs. Kulmus's tentative map and graded. And then it adds to that roadways, realigned roadways. This is a new easement here. This is a realigned roadway here, 50-foot wide roadway. Doesn't include any of the grading, the drainage issues, the landscaping, or anything else. This is the only map that was in existence at the time of the affidavits were signed. But back to the point of the affidavit. If there had been an authorization for the authorization to apply, not an approval. The city never treated them as approvals. I mean, we wouldn't have been here if they were consents. No one ever said, in the course of all the hearings that they had at the Planning Commission and the City Council, that, well, you know, we've got these affidavits. Why isn't that good enough? Nobody came up with this argument that the affidavits were anything more than, you know, forms required by the city as part of their bureaucratic process until after... until the lawsuit was filed, until after the approvals and everything else. You know, before the city council, it was always a concession that there was no agreement. Nobody treated this as an agreement or an authorization of any kind. And even if they hadn't, if this affidavit hadn't been signed by Mrs. Kulmus, couldn't change the fact that the Pines had existing easement rights. They had 50-foot wide roadway access easements through Coolmus under Land Map 57. Nothing could change those. So they could build on those with or without an affidavit. Probably used up all my time, but a point I did want to make is that, you know, the court erred here, even if you're going to say there was an agreement to negotiate, erred in imposing an agreement on the on Coolmus. It cannot be an exercise of bad faith not to make an agreement on exactly the terms of the other side. You know, that's an agreement for capitulation. That's not negotiation.
We interrupted your presentation with some questions, and we had some difficulty with the map, so I'm going to add some time to your argument. But an area I think the panel is interested in would be your views about the remedy that the court selected if there was an enforceable agreement to negotiate. Some jurisprudence would suggest that those remedies are not specific performance but are in the nature of damage remedies. Would you care to comment on that?
Yes, I would.
I thought you might.
First of all, specific performance of an agreement to negotiate would be an order to negotiate. That's what specific performance means, not an enforcement of an agreement imposed by the court utilizing its ideas of what would be in the best interest of the parties, which is not the court's role. My argument would be there's no evidence at all here of an agreement to negotiate. If you go back to the time of the affidavits, no one ever said, I'll give you this affidavit.
We understand that.
Okay.
We're assuming
that. We're going to assume that. In terms of a remedy, the one remedy that is clearly not within the law of agreements to negotiate is enforcement of the terms imposed by one party. An agreement to negotiate, to the extent they are enforceable, are complete in themselves. The only obligation is to negotiate. There is no obligation to come to an agreement. A definition of bad faith under an agreement to negotiate can't be based on not coming to an agreement on the terms of one side or the other. It's a catch-22. Mrs. Coolmus either agrees to everything the Pines proposes or she's in bad faith. That can't be the way it works. In terms of, can the court impose a different kind of agreement? Not unless there are terms that you could base that agreement. There's some law, for instance, where the parties have agreed on everything. There's a loan commitment and there's agreement to negotiate on interest rates, and then at the last minute there's some attempt to renegotiate the original price or something, and that's bad faith. And the court can say, well, I'm just going to impose the standard interest rate. That's one kind of, we could fill in an open term using some kind of objective standard. The terms here, there are no terms. The only term anybody looking for was relocation. And it isn't true that the only alternative for relocation was the Pines one. The previous engineers had a different location. The Pines people themselves insisted time and again to the city that they could use the existing easements. That's an alternative. And there are 500 acres here. They could have built that road straight up through Aslanian. There are lots of alternatives here.
Would an appropriate remedy be the cost that was incurred in negotiating rather than specific performance? The cost that a party had to go through after believing that there was an arrangement that was appropriate?
The short answer to that is yes, if there were such costs. Clearly, it's not expectation damages either. In this case, if there had been an agreement to negotiate, it was still limited to an agreement to negotiate on relocation. They still wouldn't have had a map that satisfied Condition 39, and they wouldn't have had the ability to sell that map. So they wouldn't, you know, they still wouldn't have their expectation damages, even, you know, and the court found those damages were too speculative, which they were here in any event. So to the extent there are expenses associated with the negotiating process as a remedy for the breach of an agreement to negotiate, you know, we're going to assume there's an agreement and assume there's a breach. That would be the remedy. Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Fullstone. Mr. Cox, I'll add 4 minutes to your time.
Do I have a couple of minutes left for a rebuttal if needed?
You do.
Thank you.
Members of the court and counsel, let me address, first of all, this issue of condition number 39, because it really puts things in askew in looking at this particular case. Condition 39 came into existence on August 2nd of 2006. And the suggestion by Mrs. Fullstone is that somehow this was proposed and came into effect as a result of the Pines engineer, Mrs. Lindell. It could not be even more contrary than that. The initial, and this was before, would be before the Planning Commission, not the City Council, the condition was put in just a couple of days before that particular meeting. It was put in by the city and brought to Mrs. Lindell. And at the time, and I'll go back and cover this, the parties were still in negotiation in good faith, they thought, to come to an agreement on the relocation of the existing easements, which everybody agreed, more particularly the engineers, was not workable on this particular property, which the city had found was the steepest and most difficult terrain the city had ever incurred in any development. So Mrs. Lindell didn't create that particular condition. It came from the city. She saw no problem in saying, hey, we're going to get this other thing because we're working toward it. But we found out only after September of that year how that came to be. And that came to be as a result of Mrs. Kulmos's son, Ross Kulmos, sending a clandestine letter to the city council on July 31st, just prior to that August 31st meeting, and saying that this was going to damage his property. They weren't in agreement with what was coming forward, but that never was communicated to anybody in the Pines at that time. It wasn't communicated ultimately until September of that year. So condition 39 was not something certainly that the Pines sought, nor that anybody thought was ever workable. If you work your way back to the beginning of this whole issue, and we can start, Justice Hardesty, as you suggest, really with that trading of affidavits, which occurred in November. Both parties absolutely needed those particular affidavits to go forward with any kind of development on the other person's property. If they weren't there, the city would not go forward. And it's something Mrs. Kulmos realized on November 10th, of 2005, she called Mrs. Lindell and said, hey, we need this affidavit. That's what my engineers are telling me. And so can we do that? Mrs. Lindell said, well, we'll need them as well. So why don't we talk about trading affidavits and confirm that and email to her? Once having done that, they got together and had a meeting on the 14th of November and spread out before you. And I can't see these maps that were put before you, but Exhibit 35 is the map that Mrs. Lindell brought before her, which showed the very roadways that would be passing over in the proposed tentative map, and they weren't substantially altered after that, that would be going through the Kulmos property, not only the portion that was existing on their then tentative map or the one they were seeking approval of, but in a portion of the rest of the property that was not a part of any development plan. It was all shown to her. It was all explained to her. Mrs. Kulmos is a very sophisticated person. She developed her own property back in 1999, 1998. She was aware of the implications and the meaning of the trading or the creation of these affidavits. In fact, she gave an affidavit at that time and accompanied by a letter that said, if in any way the development that I'm signing on to significantly varies from what from what you're showing me now, which was another map, I'm assuming, but then I'm going to withdraw, which can be done with an affidavit, my particular affidavit, which would block your development. In this particular case, from that November date, and it really began in June, the engineers of the two parties, Summit for Mrs. Colmos, the Wood Rogers for the Pines, were exchanging information, including not only the actual location of the various roadways that would replace the existing the easements, which were totally unbuildable, would create walls that were 80-foot high, places where snow couldn't be removed, would be danger to anybody falling in them. They were working together, and they came up with the various plans, including the Kurva. I mean, the Pines plan was going along with what was said. There were only three objections raised by the engineer for Mrs. Colmos. Each of those objections was answered. One related to going up the hill in this Collin area development at a higher rate of descent, so it could go up to 10% rather than 8%. And engineer for Summit said no, I mean for Wood Rogers says no problem, that was corrected. The other question was the width of a roadway down in part of the development that was approved by way of tentative map. That was agreed to. The third one was an issue relating to the roadways that were designed by Wood Rogers crossing a portion of the properties that were already part of the tentative map that was sought to be approved, and that was agreed as well. There was never any other objection by the engineer. There was never any other objection by Mrs. Colmos, or never any objection by Ross Colmos that was known by the Pines until finally Ross Colmos in September, and I believe it was September 23rd, when this was coming before the City Council, the tentative map, then at that point he delivered a letter talking about the damages, the poor location, and immediately left the meeting, which cut the entire process off so that it could not be approved at that time. But the key here is when Mrs. Colmos came for her particular tentative map, which she needed the traded affidavit for, she came before the council on January 18th. On January 18th, she got her phase 2 and 3 approved. And those were the very maps that were being used by Wood Rogers to comply with her particular development, and then extending those on to the rest of the property going into the Pines property. But understand this, the tentative map, both the Pines tentative map that was ultimately filed in February of the same year, and the tentative map that was filed by Mrs. Colmos and approved, had not only location, but they had slope. It showed total slope, what would be built and how it would be built, because that's what the City Council is really approving. So Mrs. Colmos, just before the meeting, and this gets to the issue.
Was that map presented, Mr. Cox?
Pardon me?
Was that map present at the meeting in November when?
In November, it was a preliminary draft. But in the months of November, going into December and January, all of those maps, the more final locations, were presented to the Summit engineer so he could see what they were, and that's when he came up with the objections that he stated. He had an opportunity to see that and realize that these affidavits that are signed have an important effect. It allows that develop. It really is an authorization and consent. It can be withdrawn. But if there was some objection to that, then Mrs. Colmos could have withdrawn her particular consent, and she never did that, and her engineers were totally on board. But in January, before her particular development, right before it came before the City Council, she wrote a letter to Mrs. Lindell, says, "I agree to participate in finding a mutually acceptable solution to access utilities for our adjacent properties. That's the only way to achieve results." Now, that's just one of many. On that same day, she wrote a letter to Mr. Kitchen that said essentially the same thing. Her engineer was working with our engineer, saying the same thing. When she came before the City Council on August I mean, it would have been the Planning Commission on August 2nd. She specifically said that she was there to support the plan that was going forward, and this was just days before her own son had submitted a clandestine letter to the city saying that he didn't agree with what was happening, he didn't like the locations, it would in fact damage his property. But fat, dumb, and happy, the Pines people continued to negotiate on roughly January 23rd, after her meeting before their city council. They got together with Mrs. Colmos. She again expressed the same type of willingness to mutually agree to come up with some solution. That doesn't mean they were agreeing to a specific, but it certainly means, and this is what the court found on the basis of substantial evidence, that this was really an agreement to negotiate in good faith. And it's something that has really been recognized by, not necessarily by this particular court, but it certainly has been recognized outside of this jurisdiction. People like Professor Farnsworth, Judge Posner, and the various treatises that are attached clearly show that this is something that should be looked at, because it doesn't necessarily mean that people have to agree, but they have to proceed in good faith. And if they don't proceed in good faith, and this is this developing area of the law that on some very solid, in solid jurisdiction, solid reasoning, if you don't proceed in good faith, then what you can end up with, if but for that bad faith, an agreement would have been reached, then the court can come in and impose that on the parties if it's definite enough, if there's really a basis for finding that. What the court did here is exactly that. He delineated the number of good faith attempts, the representations, the misleading representations by both Ross Colmos and his mother, and found that ultimately that bad faith came into effect because Ross Colmos had two communications before September 23rd, when this issue was going to come before the city council, indicating his objection, never communicated in any way with the Colmoses. In addition to that, what he found, that although the engineers had been participating together and exchanging information and finding out if there were any objections, which the Pines found there were objections, and they corrected that, they only found out after the fact that on March 6th, Mr. Colmos, the son, got together with his engineer and said, hey, King's X, I don't want you to communicate with this other side anymore. I want everything to be confidential. I want you to let me know if they contact you and tell them that they must talk with me, not you, along the way. Unknown completely. One of the things the judge found is the Colmoses, even though there's no objections along the way, they went to their engineer, they went to him and said, hey, listen, come up with some alternatives. Consider crossing the ravines in a different way. Consider some other alternative here. And he exactly did that. Those alternatives were never shown. There were three of them. Never shown to the Pines people, and only discovered during the process of discovery. As a result, and afterwards, once finding them and trying to still work with this issue, those were found to be something that certainly could have been acceptable to the Pines people, but they were never shown.
And let me go back to the points you just discussed.
Yes, Justice.
Agreements to negotiate, agreements to agree, haven't been recognized in Nevada, and in fact, we don't like them in Nevada. Our case law is contrary. So you're urging us to veer from that path and look at adopting those types of agreements to agree. Is your position entirely based upon us recognizing agreements to negotiate in good faith or agreements to agree? And the district court in its order cited essentially, I believe, a Third Circuit case to support its position that agreements to negotiate in good faith are recognizable.
Yes. And I think they are, and there's a sound reason for that.
Well, I know other jurisdictions have adopted it. We specifically have not. In fact, we've addressed it as soon as recent as 2005.
And agreements to agree are clearly not enforceable unless the parties reach agreement. Agreements negotiated in good faith are not enforceable. The parties can listen to one another and decide if they've made a good faith effort to negotiate and worked along the way. And if any of these objections would have come up, and the judge pointed that out during his final findings and his ruling in the set, if Mrs. Comos would have come forward and said, hey, we've been damaged. This is going to be the Great Wall of China up here. We're not going to make any profits. Or we need to have a different location. We need to consider alternatives. Those were all options open to her, which is the protection of the person who's being looked at here.
And opposing counsel, apart from that point, opposing counsel indicated, Ms. Fullstone indicated that they did object to the fact that you were pursuing this agreement to negotiate in good faith, and Nevada didn't recognize that. Do you agree with that? Was that raised?
There was objections raised by them, and it was raised initially on appeal, and that was dropped on appeal. There's nothing in the appendix going forward or in her argument dealing with the question of whether the judge improperly granted a motion to amend based upon evidence that had come in. And there was so much evidence that came in, apart from anything relating to the underlying claims itself, on agreements by the Comos side to negotiate in good faith, come to a reasonable resolution, while on the other side, underneath the table, doing things to sabotage that very event, that I think that was very persuasive to the judge, along with serious questions relating to the credibility of Mrs. Comos and her interpretation and her version of the facts relating to the exchange of affidavits. In fact, at the time, what the judge asked of her, what is there that you can tell me that would help persuade me that what the story you're telling me has some credibility to it, because I don't see it. Tell me anything that you can tell me. Her ultimate point is the truth is sometimes stranger than fiction. Well, lawsuits are not about things being stranger than fiction. This is a very unique case, I must say, because of the way it went forward, the interchange between the parties, the Wood Rogers continually modifying whatever it could do, and really it could have received approval of its tentative map on September 26th.
Going back to one more point that I would like to have you address, Justice Hardesty had indicated whether or not specific performance would, yes, in any event, be the proper measure of damages. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. It seems to me like if the assuming we were to recognize agreements to negotiate in good faith, if you apply specific performance, that would be your remedy, is to negotiate in good faith and not require anything beyond that. Perhaps costs.
But the the developing law really states, and this is what the judge found, that but for the bad faith, an agreement would have been entered here that would have been along the lines of the parties' tentative maps. Both of them had tentative maps on file that were approved. Both of them had slope easements. All of that was in place. And you obviously need slope easements. The very things that a development is about is that. Not a sharing of costs, because he specifically excluded that. But he clearly found that but for this bad faith, because the engineers were in agreement, the seemingly the parties were in agreement, but for what was happening underneath the surface, that what he found was, I'll take the tentative maps of these two people and what they have there with the three changes suggested by their engineer, which is certainly definite. It was certainly discussed. It happened over 8 or 9 months without objection, and find that that's what would have happened had it not been for the bad faith of the parties, so that this can go forward on the basis of what those tentative maps showed. And so the protection really is, first of all, you really have to have, and this is a massive finding of bad faith, what you have to have, may I continue, Your Honor?
Yes.
What you have to have is the kind of showing that came forth in this this particular case, and the record is redolent with it. With the bad faith, the representations on the side of the Colmos that, hey, everything is fine, until it finally breaks down. And we should have had that approval there, and but for them doing that, that's why the court came to that conclusion. And the way he did it in his findings of fact and conclusion of law was kind of unique. He said, you know, this is a simple matter if you really start looking at it and looking at the facts in this case. And he had outlined all of that. And I believe that to be the case. And I think specific performance is something available here, as in your Dynalectric case, where you said, hey, you have to look at all kinds of remedies that would be available. This is a remedy, the only kind of fair remedy that you could have. You could also, I believe, have reliance damages if this doesn't work. But I believe that specific performance is screened out to for here, or this Judge Adams would have never done that.
Mr. Cox, if this court were to write an opinion in this case and adopt this as a theory of relief, have you given any thought as to what the opinion would say that would describe the elements so that courts in the future would be able to assess such a claim?
Sure, and I think that those are really
one of the elements of remedy, which
I understand
part of it, but the elements of the claim itself.
I think the elements of the claim are really spelled out by people such as Professor Farnsworth, who came from the other side of the fence and came up with a series of elements that would have to be fulfilled. And that, I believe, is what the judge did in this case, follow that kind of directive. Now, I haven't, and I wouldn't presume to write an opinion for this court, but I know that the elements would have to contain bad faith. It would, I mean, abject bad faith. It would have to contain a conclusion that, but for that bad faith, then an agreement would be reached. What that agreement would have to be would be definite and certain, and that's what the court found in the two tentative maps that were out there as it was modified by the party's own engineer and agreed to and put into the handbook of the Pines people. And then the other elements would be moving forward really with taking a look at the factual basis to see if that was justified. But I think that the Farnsworth, the Burton analyses have really come to that we have to be realistic to look to all kinds of remedies and all kinds of claims if there is a reason to do it. Now, it may be the rare case that you find that. And I think this is one of those cases that screams out for that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cox. Any other questions by my colleagues?
Do I have any more reservation?
You can cover for 1 minute your cross appeal.
Okay.
I mean, I touched on that a little bit already. But,
okay. Okay, fine. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sue Ellen Fullstone again. First of all, address the argument that Condition 39 did not come from the Pines. I refer you to Appendix 2414, which is an email from Melissa Lindell to Denny Peters of the city in response to an email from Mr. Peters. And this email says, Denny, in the event there is not an agreement, you can add a condition that we will have to construct all necessary infrastructure and improvements in the existing easements. You can also condition that if we use these easements, that all improvements in the existing easements would be owned and maintained by the Pines Homeowners Association unless other arrangements were made. I believe that barring an agreement, we would be able to add the decorative bridge look treatments to the drainage crossings within the existing 50-foot easements. So it is not true that Condition 39 was something that came from the city. It was something that came from Mrs. Lindell.
Can you state the date of that email, please?
The date of that email is July 25th, 2006. I want to talk about the specifics of the bad faith argument. Mr. Cox says it was abject bad faith on the part of Colmos, in consisting of clandestine communications with the city. The only reason that Ross Colmos
wrote letters to the city authorities explaining to them, which was absolutely true, that there was no agreement on easements, is because the Kulmuses were excluded from the meetings that the Pines had with the city, with Tumwa, with the fire department. It was the non-disclosure on the part of the Pines group that left Kulmus with no knowing what the city had been told. We knew, you know, Kulmus knew that the city had originally been told that Kulmus was an applicant, and Kulmus was clearly not an applicant. They were just affected by this. In terms of the three changes that were made, it's really incorrect to say that this was reviewed by the engineers and so on. The three changes were made to conform to the Kulmus tentative map, which was approved first, and those changes would have been required by the city. Kulmus didn't start looking at the Pines proposal until after their own map was approved. This idea that excluding engineers from talking to each other is somehow bad faith, another, you know, issue that comes out of nowhere. These were Kulmus engineers. Mrs. Kulmus said in the very first meeting with the Pines, it would behoove you to deal with me, not my engineers, because I'm making this design decision. This is not an engineering decision.
All right, thank you, Ms. Fullstone. I'll give you 1 minute to respond to the cross-appeal argument, which will be confined to the remedy issue. Mr. Cox? Ms. Fullstone, you can be seated now, and you'll have that chance.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were giving me one more minute to respond. You're giving him that minute. I was trying to figure out what I was going to say.
You're going to get a minute. You'll hear something I'm sure you won't like, and you'll want to say something about it.
Well, Your Honor, with limited time, I think we've set this out on our brief, but we quite clearly feel that restitution damages would be available here in the event the court rejects the specific performance. And it would have to go back to the court. They'd have to weigh the evidence relative to the various appraisals and what the appraisals mean, and we've set that out in the brief. But we believe that the restitution would be the type of damage that would be given to us had this not been breached by the failure to carry forward in good faith under this. And that's the very type of thing that this court has talked about and looked at, and all the types of damages are not exclusive to one another, and it must be looked at from a viewpoint of fairness. It would not be simply the amount that we had expended, but it would be the amount that we should have gotten had this gone forward and agreed to. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Cox? Nope. All right. Ms. Fullstone, you may respond to that argument.
I would just reiterate that I believe that if, in fact, the court found that there was an agreement to negotiate here, the remedy for the breach, and they found that there was a breach, the remedy for that breach would be what the court suggested, which is the cost of any negotiation that took place, not expectation, not restitution, not reliance. Clearly, the evidence does not support any claim that the Pines went forward here based on an agreement to negotiate. The agreement to negotiate was a last-minute theory that 4.5 years after the fact raised by their lawyers. It was never argued, never raised with the city, an argument for that they were spending money going forward based on any such agreement to negotiate. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Fullstone. The panel thanks you and Mr. Cox, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Sue for your fine briefing and arguments here today. The matter will stand submitted.